The following is intended solely for the use of those with a sense of adventure.
I'm shaking the dust of this town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world.
This is Travel with Hawkeye. Here's your host, Mark Hawkeye Lewis.
I love island life, and I love the Caribbean. I try to visit as many of the islands in the Caribbean as I can, and there's one particular island that really draws a lot of people who are rich and famous and is hard to get to. It's called St. Barts, and there's a brand new book from Lyle Greenfield called 1,000 Days in St. Barts. It's available on Amazon, and it's a fascinating read if you've ever wanted to know more about this unusual place in the Caribbean. And we're going to delve into why it's so unusual and what makes it so special. But first of all, Lyle joins us today. And the 1,000 days in St. Barts, that's not all at once, right? That's over many, many years.
Yes, that is correct. Mm. It's approximately 38 years since I first landed on the island in 1984.
Okay. And I've actually had a chance to go to the island once, and I was fascinated by it, and it's absolutely one of the most beautiful islands in the Caribbean. I've been to many of the Caribbean islands, and in my opinion, I think it's one of the most beautiful islands. It has a lot to offer, though it is very, very small, is it not?
It is very small, and that's an advantage, I think, in some respects, but also potentially a liability, because it's so popular as a resort destination for the very rich and the very famous, that there's been a lot of development. And the question of, you know, where does it go from here is sort of an annual one that's raised by residents, environmentalists, people concerned about the lasting charms of this beautiful little island. But I keep going back. And whenever I speak with first-time visitors, they don't have this awareness of what it was 38 years ago, or in some cases, you know, 50 years ago. And they're just sort of swooning over the beauty of it, the friendliness, the great beaches. Maybe I'm a little bit spoiled, or my viewpoint is slightly tainted as someone who's known it back when, if you will, when we first were going to this island.
Well, before we get to that, and that's the thing that I was so fascinated by, because when I went there, the island is different from any other island in the Caribbean. And when I started to find out that you actually been to the island before it is like it is now, it just blew me away, because I've always wondered how it became what it is. But let's first talk about real quickly what St. Barts is now, because a lot of islands in the Caribbean, there's limited resources for agriculture, for any type of industry. And a lot of people leave the islands and go like to New York City and have jobs in New York City to support family back in different islands in the Caribbean. And most of the jobs seem to be in most places in the Caribbean, tourist-based jobs. And if you can't get one of those, then it's a tough existence in many of these islands. And a lot of islands, there's a lot of poverty, and there's people that are, you know, it's just struggling to get by. When I went to St. Barts, beautiful like all the other islands in the Caribbean, but I noticed that there didn't seem to be hardly any poverty, and there was the day that I was there, I saw young women hitchhiking on the island, and you would never see that on any other island in the Caribbean. There was just a whole different vibe. And as you've mentioned previously, moments ago, there is, you know, it is a destination for the rich and the beautiful, but it's also just a different kind of vibe on the island. Is that not fair to say?
I think it is fair to say, and it's also one of the things that appealed to me most from the very beginning. You know, my career for the most part has been in New York City, and the idea of taking a vacation to a beautiful place and then feeling bad because you're confronted with, you know, let's say extraordinary poverty, and here you didn't see it on St. Barts. And I think one reason is that, you know, historically, as you mentioned, Mark, there was no agricultural possibility on this island. It's a small volcanic rock in the Caribbean. And very little fresh water except what falls from the heavens and into the cisterns. So there was no slave trade in the 16th, 1700s to speak of. There were maybe less than 100 slaves brought to the island in the very early days to help build things in the port. And then for the French in the mid-1800s, slavery was abolished, which I find interesting, actually, because it was abolished there before in our own country. There was little for these folks to do, so many moved off the island to find opportunities elsewhere. So its foundation has been as a port, you know, a place from which things could be transported to other islands or the continent of North America or South America. Columbus discovered this island, and he named it after his brother, Bartolomeo. But the Spanish never settled there, which I'm kind of thankful for, to be honest. But, you know, that's a bit of the history, I think, that explains the fact that there isn't this level of poverty on the island.
So that being said, when you started going to the island, well, I guess I should ask, really, when did the island start to develop as a tourist destination? Because I could kind of tell there's nothing here on this island. There is no agriculture. There's very little support on the island. And it's just this beautiful destination. How did it become what it is?
Well, it goes, I would say, back to 1950-ish, which, you know, in our lifetimes is a fairly short time ago, mm-hmm. when people like Rockefeller and Greta Garbo and some other people discovered this beautiful little destination, where at the time there was only sort of one somewhat renowned hotel that had been created by an aviator and entrepreneur named Remy DeHaene, who landed the first plane on this island in the 1950s. I have this date specifically referenced in the book, but he landed his Cessna plane in a field in the Bay Saint-Jean, and he was the first to land a plane there, and to this day, the airport is named after him. The runway is too short to have jets come to the island, so you have to either fly to Puerto Rico or fly to St. Martin in order to take a smaller plane, a prop plane, to the island of St. Barts. So I think that for many people, that's a plus. In other respects, what became attractive about the island in the decades to follow were, I don't know whether this is an accident or whether we credit early zoning, but there are no high rises on this island. There is no golf course. There are no casinos. So it's been able to, even with the modernizations, maintain a level of charm that you don't find in other Caribbean islands that are sort of heavy with the resort vibe,
yeah.
so to speak.
Yeah. When did you start going there? You said in the
80s? 1984.
What was it like in 1984? Was it well developed, or was it still becoming to what it is now?
Well, it's one of those things where it's always been becoming. I mean, there's no way that, you know, that I discovered the joys and beauties of this treasure, this secret thing. I believe, according to pop culture lore, that Billy Joel met his wife, Christie Brinkley, his future wife, mm-hmm. On the island in the late 70s. And she was on a swimsuit visit, I guess. I guess you could call it a business trip. And Billy Joel was vacationing on the island and playing piano at some joint. And that's, I believe, where they met each other. So, you know, at some point in the couple of decades before I arrived on the island, it was becoming popular. It was becoming a destination. Mm-hmm. It's a place that was, you know, a bit special, where you wouldn't find, you know, sort of everybody, including the paparazzi, looking out for you, trying to track you down. It's a very different world today, but when I first came, there was no euro, for example. It was the French franc. And at that time in 1984, the dollar versus the franc, it was almost 10 to 1. So we were staying in a relay and chateau hotel.
10-1 Wow. That's amazing. I'm just like, it blew my mind. 10-1 That must have been fantastic as an American.
Well, it was crazy because you think, well, I have to go to, you know, I have to go to Mexico or I have to go to some, you know, Eastern European nation to get, you know, these sorts of values. But here it was, you know, fairly close to home on a sophisticated island. And it was, you know, langoust dinner for two with a bottle of rosé for $39. that ain't the way it is today.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you this. You mentioned earlier that there's no fresh water on the island other than what people catch by, you know, by catchment. I have to imagine that has limited the growth also on the island, that it can only sustain so many people. Is that fair to say?
Well, that would be fair to say. And, you know, up until, I'm going to say 15 to 20 years ago, it was the case that the fresh water was literally coming from the cisterns. And, you know, your hotel room would say, please don't run the water while you're brushing your teeth, you know, because we're saving all that we can. But over the past, I guess you'd say 15 to 20 years, fresh water, public water has become available on the island. It is, I assume, without knowing so much about the island's infrastructure, it is from desalinated water.
Oh, okay, okay.
But all of the hotels, all of the restaurants, and I think the vast majority of homes, even the traditional cottages on the island, would now have fresh water.
Okay.
And occasionally there's a breakdown in that system, and suddenly no one on half of the island has fresh water.
Wow. Speak to this, if you would, because this was one of the most amazing things I've seen on any island in the Caribbean, is the experience in landing from a small prop plane at the airport in St. Barts, because it is quite an experience.
Well, I'm going to speak as someone who's sort of a chicken in the sky.
Okay, perfect. Like, perfect, makes it even better.
You know, so if I'm up in the air, far above the surface of the earth, and we hit turbulence, Lyle has to put down his book and start meditating. Now, it can be alarming, that landing in the small airport, because you have to you come over a hillside, and then the plane needs to drop suddenly to come to the forward-looking lip of this runway and get the wheels on the ground before it gets to the beach.
Yes, because the runway stops right at the public beach. And if you're at the beach, you're seeing this happen all day long. I mean, the planes literally stop right before the sand starts.
Exactly. And, you know, for, well, at least three decades, you know, you could walk back and forth on the beach and people would walk right in front of the runway and wait for a plane to come in or take off. And because they wanted to, you know, take the famous photograph of the underbelly of a small plane. And there was one occasion in which someone got their head bumped by a plane while they were trying to do this. And the aviation authorities in France said, guess what? You're going to put a fence there or we're closing your airport. So there was a lot of uproar over this. Like, we don't want a fence blocking our walk back and forth. But they did it. And everyone lived happily ever after. I'm not saying that no one has ever perished because of this landing. It is a little exciting. But for me, as a frightened flyer, so to speak, I'd rather be in a small plane, like where I can see the surface of the water or the surface of the earth, and think to myself, okay, we're really close now.
There's also another aspect to this airport. You said, you know, the plane comes over a hill before it has to drop down really fast onto the runway. At the top of that hill, if I recall correctly, there's a road, And I remember being on that road, and all of a sudden there was a plane that was like inches from the top of my car, because that's a public road at the top of the hill.
It's, Mark, you're right. It's kind of alarming, depending on where you are. And it's also interesting to see, you know, they haven't fenced off the top of the hill. So what happens is people will pull over, get out, get their little movie cameras or iPhones, and, you know, wait for the next plane to come in. It's become, you know, maybe a bit of a tourist cliche. But, you know, so far no one's been knocked off the hill, so to speak. So I'm always thinking to myself, especially if it's a young pilot who appears to be maybe 20, I think, God, I hope you've done this a bunch of times, brother.
Yeah. So the book, let's talk about the book here, A Thousand Days in St. Bart's. Tell me about the concept behind this, because this is really like 30 plus years of you visiting this island and some of the characters and places that have come and gone over the past 30 years. You've really captured the flavor of this place in the book.
Well, I appreciate your saying that. You know, initially what happened was that my wife and I took a very serendipitous and spontaneous vacation in spring of 2019. And she is a, she's been a language teacher, a Spanish teacher, her entire career. And she is not Hispanic, but also has a master's degree in English as a second language. So we're on this little 5-day trip in May of 2019. And Mary sees an ad in a local newspaper. Hey, they're looking for an English teacher, this little school. And I said, well, do you want to check it out? Should I? Well, why not? It's just an interview. So she ended up being hired for a semester, the fall semester of that very year. And we're pretty excited because I'd never spent more than 3 weeks, 4 weeks at a time on the island. And now we were going to spend hurricane season.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yay. What would that be like? The rents were lower, of course, because, you know, half or more of the island is closed in September, October, and reopening in early November again. So people would say to me, what are you going to do? Your wife is teaching full time. And I said, well, I'll rake the beaches. But I thought I needed something constructive to do, and I decided to take a shot at writing this book. So she was going to be, you know, literally in school at 8 a.m. with a 2-hour break for lunch. And she would be back until 6 p.m. And I thought, well, I have to use this time constructively. And I have to use her schedule as a way to define the time that I'm spending. Because I'm not just going to go to the beach.
Yeah.
You know, and be the lazy tourist husband while my wife is working for pennies on the dollar. So I sat and, you know, made a goal. I'm going to write 1,000 or 1,500 words a day. And, you know, you start out with a concept for the book. I started out with chapter headings, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then I expanded the list of people that I thought it would be appropriate for me to meet. And I think that the draft of the book was substantially finished at that time, between mid-September and mid-December of 2019. And then I had promised each of the interviewees that, look, you're going to be the editor of this chapter. I'm not a journalist, so I'm not interested in any part of your story that you were, you know, unwilling or uncomfortable telling me. But I had my most interesting interview, Mark, was with the president of the island, the 3-time president, Bruno McGraw. And I mentioned that because, and he decided not to run for a 4th term at the age of 71. But I sat with him. We were kind of peers age-wise. His English was not great. But he told me that when he was a child, so this would have been in the 50s, There were no roads the way we see them now. There were no cars the way you see them on the island now. No fresh water, running water, no electricity, which means no refrigeration. Mm-hmm. So his father, his grandfather would go to the salt flats, get salt, and that's how they preserve the meat and fish. And here's a guy who was walking with his brothers to school 3 miles a day to Gustavia, the port, and the public school there. And he was describing to me, and this is in my lifetime, a situation that didn't exist in terms of lack of development that existed in our country in the mid-1800s and late 1800s. Mm-hmm. In other words, we didn't have automobiles on the road until basically the beginning of the 20th century. So here we are on this island in the 1950s with no cars on the road. And the roads were basically buggy and donkey trails.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It's amazing when you think about that. It's really fascinating. That's what I found so interesting, because I've always wondered, like, what is the history of this island? What was it like? Because I couldn't imagine that it had a very vibrant past, which, you know, from your book, I've gathered that it didn't. And then how did it become this glamorous spot on the planet? It's just a complete 180 from what it used to be. And as you said, you know, there's a man there who remembers everything, how it changed step by step. It's a fast. If you've ever been to St. Bart's or interested in going or heard about it, this is a great book. It's called 1,000 Days in St. Bart's. Lyle Greenfield, thank you for sharing with us your experiences and something about this amazing place that so many people have either wanted to visit or have visited and really don't know a lot about, other than a lot of rich people go there. It's kind of become a rich enclave. It really is a fascinating story.
Well, I appreciate the time, Mark, and your questions have been penetrating. challenged my own memories, so I hope to see you on the beach there in the near future.
All right, and we will go up to the fence at the airport, but not around it.
Okay, you got a deal.
Once again, the book is called 1,000 Days in St. Barth by Lyle Greenfield, and you've been listening to the Travel with Hawkeye podcast. I'm Mark Hawkeye Lewis. The world is out there. Your adventure awaits.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draftaccess to register for free entry today.